Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 298, and we're going to talk about Amazon Prime deals, but not in the way you might expect. I'm not going to have any links to any products. I just want to point something out to you. We're also going to talk about flashlights, note the pronunciation, and which ones you should have in your van, and a place to visit that you can't drive to unless you spend a whole lot of money, but it's still worth doing. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Thanks for joining me once again. I have come back from RMSS, and I will tell you that story when we get to that part. But let us jump right the heck in to Prime Days. That's right, folks. It's Amazon Prime Days. Get to your keyboards and buy everything you possibly can, because prices will never be lower, lower, lower. Well, yeah, whatever. There's an awful lot of hype about all this stuff. And, you know, it used to be Patriots Day sales or Black Friday. Folks, you know, this day and age, I think the idea of a sale season is rather overblown. I mean, it's always sale season. We carry around these little devices in our pockets that let us buy anything we want, anytime we want, and there's always constant pressure on retailers to keep prices as low as possible, depending on the item and economics, etc., etc., etc. So the idea of loss leaders is kind of not what it used to be. These big sale days are not what they used to be. And Prime Day, which used to be a single day that started as promotion to get people to sign up for Prime, ain't what it used to be, unsurprisingly. And I have noticed a trend that I find rather annoying. Now, there is a feature in Amazon when you look up an item. So I'm going to do this with you live. We're going to do it live. Here we go. So I'm going to Amazon.com. Okay. Shop Prime Deals. All right. Well, let's look at something that I might actually want. So I particularly like Stanley cookware. Not the red mugs. I don't care about that. I have been using these Stanley cook kits that I bought, way over 10 years ago. They're stainless steel, they're really tough, really well built, and they do an excellent job and take up very little space in your rig. I've talked about them in the past. I've got two of them that they don't make anymore. One is a pot that has a couple of bowls and utensils like a spatula and spoon and a couple of cutting boards in it that I use all the time. And a tall one that is for boiling water, and inside it is two plastic insulated cups. And that's basically all I need. I mean, a frying pan. I also carry around a cheap frying pan to add to that. But that's all my cookware. But hey, Stanley's got a new version of this cookware. So let's take a look. So I type in Stanley cookware. And look at that. The Stanley Wildfare Go. Wildfare Go. 14-piece stainless steel prep and cook set, 1.65-quart saucepan with fold and lock handle, bowls, and utensils. It is $32.81. Now, that is a good price. That is well worth it to me. I would recommend that product, although this one is a little different than the one I have because, you know, it's new and improved. Okay, whatever. The item doesn't actually matter for this example. What I want to look at is the price. So when we look at the listing here, it says $32.81, down 6% from the typical price of $34.72. That's great. That's a Prime special. I should buy that right now because I'm saving, I'm saving less than $2, but it's still money. So sure. But there's a little tiny link next to the price on Amazon called Price History. And when I click on that Price History link, I see something interesting. The interesting part is this item usually is about $34, like it says, $34.72. But then on May 5th, it jumped up to $35 and something. And then just before Prime Day in June, the price dropped down. Okay, I don't know what generates the pricing of these things, but hey, it's still cheaper now than it has been. Let's see. Let's go back. The price over a year? Sure. Right now, it is the cheapest it's ever been. That's the end of the argument, isn't it? I mean, it should be, except, oh wait, look. It was also lower on the last Prime Day, and that's kind of interesting. So, but the price went up just before Prime Day. Could it be that retailers are raising the price of everything in May so that they'll look that much cheaper in June when Prime Day happens? Well, let's test that theory. So I need a solar panel. I do actually need a solar panel. I need a 200-watt flexible solar panel that will fit on the roof of my camper pod thing. And let's see if that pattern holds. So, okay, let's see. 100-watt, I want 200-watt. 200-watt. Bouge RV Arch Pro 200 watts. Okay, that's a pretty good one. Anti-shading, it's not the right size, but whatever. Again, the item doesn't matter. We're just looking at this for comparison. I go down here. It says $227.97, 24% off. Okay, that's a good savings. And I click on price history. And yeah, look at that. This one's really interesting. So it was $302 on about May 28th. The dates are kind of approximate with the tool. You can't really tell. And then in June, it went down a little bit. And then it went down kind of a lot the week before Prime Day. But then the day before Prime Day, it shot back up again to $265. And now, once again, it is the lowest price it's ever been. But it's kind of a weird comparison because it's been close to this price before and they raised the price just before Prime Day. So what am I supposed to make of that? Is this really a deal? Well, when I go back in history for a year, again, it is the lowest price it has been within a year. And that pretty much settles it. But the savings isn't quite as much as you'd think because most of the time, it's only a couple dollars more than it is right now. In fact, if you look back at the pattern over a year, what you see is a flat line with spikes. There's spikes in the price, and those spikes tend to align with shopping events. There's one for Black Friday, there's one near Christmas, there's one near New Year's, and Patriots Day. You can line this up with a calendar and see anytime there's a sales event, they ramp up the price just before and then lower it again to make it look like it's a better savings. So are they cheating? Is this evil? I would say yes, but it is also not unusual. I have seen this pattern way back since I was a kid shopping at Caldor, a long-forgotten brand, and I noticed that if you bought stuff maybe mid-November, it was super expensive, and then it was on sale just before Black Friday. So I just didn't buy anything then because I figured out the pattern. The pattern is the same here. The takeaway is this. On Prime Day, or Prime Week as it is now, you absolutely can find the lowest prices of the year. I've looked at the data. That's what the data shows. So that's the end of the story. Except it's not, because you don't always buy things on a date. You buy things when you need them. And unfortunately, there are times of the year where there are anti-Prime Days. There are prices that are higher. And the pattern I'm seeing, without doing any kind of scientific research, I'm just looking at things generally here to be clear, it looks like 2 weeks before any major sales event, prices go up. That means if you are shopping 2 weeks before Prime Day, you're going to be paying the most it's ever been, which according to this, for this panel that's now $227, was $302. The jump is not small. This thing's standard normal price, according to this chart I'm looking at, is about $240. But on those spike days, it went up as high as $302. So given that, I present to you a possible strategy for shopping on Amazon. Don't buy things the day you want them unless you can't help it. Always look at price history and see if the price history makes sense. If the price has suddenly gone up for that item you want to buy, wait a few days. wishlist it, keep it in your cart, whatever. Just wait, because it's probably going to go back down again. Now, not all items follow this pattern. There's several things I looked at where the line is just flat or has mild fluctuations. They're clearly not paying the prime game. And I don't know if Amazon is encouraging this of sellers, or if they're just doing it with products that they stock, or I don't know any of the specifics of that, and I also don't care. All I care about is that this is the phenomenon, and there are times when things are cheaper on Amazon, but it's not always when you think. So, absolutely, when you go to Amazon, look at that price history button, and I'm sure you're going to find this across other retailers too. I wouldn't be surprised if Walmart did this, or Vivor, or Target, or Best Buy, or whomever. It's a predatory type of marketing that I absolutely do not approve of, but it's a real phenomenon. Van life news. All right, we're going to jump right into what I actually consider to be pretty devastating news. In fact, I was all set to do a podcast last week, and then I got this news, and it just took all the wind out of my sails. And that is that VanFest has been canceled forever. That's right. Lance and his wife have decided that they can no longer continue VanFest, and they've canceled all events, including Escape to the Cape this fall. And this makes me sad, because this was an event that I wanted to make an annual event that I always went to. I only made it to two of them because of circumstances. I was planning on going to Escape the Cape in August, but I hadn't made any firm plans for it. And, well, now it's all gone. And there's two main reasons I'm very sad about this. One is that I was starting to make community with folks. I knew people, you know, there's several people I could see at VanFest and like just instantly hang out with because we've already hung out. We know each other. It was fun. That's the part of the community thing that these events drive. The other thing is that it was an East Coast event and they're not that common. I don't particularly want to go to Florida in February, but I did for these folks. Cape Cod, yes, I would like to go there. I happen to like Cape Cod, despite the touristy crap. But yeah, it's gone. So what's the future of VanFest, and why did it go away? Well, according to Lance's letter, which I have linked in the show notes, but you can go just to VanFestUSA.com to see it, they just don't have time to run it anymore. It's not a matter of debt. It's not a matter of being unable to find space. It's nothing like that. It's just that putting on events like this are a ton of work. I have done them before many, many, many times. I'm still doing them. Not VanFest events, but I'm, you know, doing all these trips for people, which has its own different challenges. But I understand exactly how much time even a simple event takes. The Salem trip that I'm hopefully doing in 2027, if the calendar stops fighting me, is enormously logistically complex, and I'm not even doing anything for people. I'll tell you more about that later, but it is unbelievable how difficult it is to plan these things. So I just want to thank Lance and his wife for doing this as long as they did. It really was a great thing. Lots and lots of friendships were made. Thousands of people attended these things. We saw rockets launch. We shared food together. We toured each other's vans. A lot of people got their start in van life in these events. And, well, anyway, it's a sad thing that it has to go, but I understand. Now, are you interested in taking up this challenge? Because VanFest is available. You can contact Lance and talk to him about the future of VanFest, because he hasn't given up on the idea. It's not that they'd hate it or anything like that. They just don't have time to do it. And there are paths to which they could turn over all their assets, which, you know, to be clear, the assets here are like the domain name and the list of people who've gone and stuff like that, to somebody who wants to carry on the mantle here and keep VanFest going. I am not that person. Some folks have suggested that, well, this is something you could do. You do this. No, no, I can't do this. I'm sorry. There was a time in my life when I would have jumped on this opportunity, but that time has passed. But maybe you love van life and you have time to turn VanFest into the event it was and could be again. Maybe you could spread it around. Maybe you can do four VanFests a year, you know, one in each corner of the U.S. Whatever. Lance is willing to talk to you to see what can be done. I have worked with Lance not only as a guest of VanFest, but as a presenter at his events and just somebody he would talk to about how this is all going. And he's an honest, good man, in my opinion. And I think if you have any interest in keeping VanFest going, and this is something you could do, I urge you to contact him because I would love to see this. And if this, I'll tell you what, I'll make a promise to you. If anybody can pick up the mantle of VanFest, I will commit to going to the next two events. I will go. I don't know what that's worth to you. I'll be a presenter. I won't be a presenter. I'll go like stay in the back 40 and just watch what's going on. However, but I will go and I will promote the hell out of it because I will really, really miss VanFest. And a totally different note, there's a new movie out there called Passengers, and no, this isn't the one about the generational spaceship where the guy wakes up early and makes some very questionable ethical choices. I believe it was Chris Pratt playing that problematic man, shall we say. No, not that movie. This is a new one, and it's about van life. It's a van life movie. It's a horror movie. Horror movies have come back in style, and well, heck, let's make a van life horror movie. And the movie starts off with a couple in a van. Shocking. They probably have a dog, too. I have not seen the movie. I'm just mentioning it here. And they come across somebody in need, and they make the fatal mistake of all horror movies. No, not the sex part. That's the other fatal mistake. No, they help somebody, which you can never, ever do in a horror movie. And, well, you know, perhaps they didn't know they were in a horror movie. We can forgive them for that. But anyway, that's the setup. They help somebody. Horror ensues. And the reviews have been kind of mixed. I have a link to one in the show notes. But, heck, maybe watching a van life movie in your van at some point would be a fun thing to do, especially a horror movie. I actually lived in an RV when Blair Witch Project came out, and I remember going to see it in the theater and then having to walk through the woods back to my trailer and it being a little creepy. So that can be kind of fun. Anyway, Passengers is out now. I've got a review in the show notes. And the last bit of news that I'm actually kind of excited about, but cautiously excited, is that Slate seems to be happening. No, not the magazine. Slate, the EV pickup truck sponsored by Jeff Bezos of Amazon. All comments aside there. But this is a $25,000 very simple EV pickup truck that is incredibly customizable. And this could be like the Volkswagen Beetle of our age, potentially. Or it could be a big flop, like so many of these things have been. Looking at you, Canoe, or Elios, and there's so many of them. But it doesn't seem to be vaporware. We know they've got money, and they're taking orders now, and the orders they're taking now are not the hold your space in line kind of orders. These are pre-orders. $300, no refunds on this $300, which is interesting because that adds an air of seriosity to this. I may have just made up a word. Apologies to Chameleons UK. But it looks like it's real. Now, is this vehicle a good van life vehicle? Well, maybe. So here are the things with me looking at this from the point of van life. It's a pickup truck with a very small bed. It's 5 feet long and only 42 inches wide, which is weird. You know, that extra 4 inches would have made sense. You could have put plywood in there with the tailgate down, but whatever. That's the size they came up with. Or you can get it with a back on it, either a fast back or a traditional SUV back if you want. I see this as something that someone's going to buy to build out with their own thing. They're not going to just like get a custom package for it. They're going to have to build it themselves. But can it handle it? I mean, this is not a big truck. And looking at the specs, yeah. I mean, this thing's got a payload of over 1,400 pounds. That's more than my truck camper weighs. So sure, you could put that much weight on there and that would work. Or it can tow, and I'm not sure what the difference is here, 1,000 to 2,000 pounds. I don't know if you add trailer brakes, if that brings it up to 2,000. I don't know what the difference is there. Maybe the different battery, because there's an extended range battery. That might be a better way to go. You could potentially get a utility trailer and build it out or something like that. I don't know. Somebody will figure this out because every vehicle is eventually turned into a camping vehicle, and this vehicle is going to be no different. But $25,000, brand new EV, And here's the kicker. What's its range? Well, standardly configured, its range is about 200 miles, which I consider a bit low for van life. They do have an extended battery that offers more, but it costs a lot more and is not even available yet, so I'm not even going to talk about it. But I am paying attention to this. I would love to go out and see slates everywhere. I really like the idea. And while Jeff Bezos doesn't need any more money, we do need more affordable vehicles in this country. And if you have a place to charge this, like at home or at work or something, this could be a very, very affordable vehicle. And it would certainly work as a base for a camping rig. Maybe you don't sleep in it, but you carry your tent and all your gear in it? Absolutely. No, it's not four-wheel drive, so don't imagine you're going to be going way off-grid. But with only a 200-mile range, I don't think you would be thinking that anyway. Anyway, I've got a link in the show notes from Fast Company where they look at this thing. And I just think it's interesting, so I offer it to you. Tech Talk. Flashlights. Yes, flashlights. I don't think I've ever talked about flashlights before, and here we are 298 or so episodes in here. Do you need a flashlight in your rig? You know, it's funny, I typically don't have a flashlight with me even when camping anymore because I've always got my phone and my phone has a flashlight. It's kind of funny how I just don't even think about it. But there have been times when I've actually needed a flashlight because I'm trying to fix something or whatever. So I just wanted to run down what, in my opinion, makes sense flashlight-wise. Flashlights, like knives, are things that people kind of obsess over, and they end up with 30 of them, and now this is my big flashlight, and this is my little flashlight, and this one is this color, and this one is this color, and you know, and all this. I don't care about any of that. I just know that there are times when I need light. And generally, I need light at night to either find my way in the dark, which isn't as common as you might think because I am of the school that less is more, that if you don't have any light, your eyes will adjust and you'll be able to see a whole lot better than you think. Then the other time is when I need to repair something at night, which happens. Like, oh, I've run out of propane, I got to switch tanks, whatever, something like that. Most of the time, if I am out at night and I need a flashlight, I'm wearing a headlight. I want a light that I don't have to think about. I just wear it around my head, and I point it where I'm looking, and I don't even have to think about it. They have red ones and white ones. There's 8 million different ones. Rechargeable or not, your choice. But that is my number one flashlight to go to. Now, let's take a look at rechargeable versus not. Here's the thing about flashlights. They're kind of an emergency device. You're going to need them when you need them. And if you have a rechargeable one and the battery is dead, you can't recharge it quickly enough to use it during that emergency in many cases. So because of that, there is an argument that your flashlight should actually use AA or C or D batteries, whichever flashlight you choose, so that you can replace those batteries instantly and have power instantly. It's something to think about here, you know, like if you use your flashlight all the time and you're always charging it every time you use it, then maybe you're okay. But that one time you forget to charge it might be the time you need it, and then you literally just don't have a flashlight because it's going to take half an hour to charge it. Whereas with the batteries, well, they're just not as good. They're a recurring expense. They just die for no reason, it seems sometimes. But you can always just get fresh ones and put them in there, provided you have the fresh ones. So you'll have to think about that. I mean, one argument is that these things are so cheap, just have one of each. Sure, I think that's fine. But a headband flashlight, for me, is far superior than to anything, even like a mag light, which seems to be more of a club than a flashlight these days. Now, that said, I have recently gotten turned on to these other flashlights that I will review in the future, but they're small, rechargeable, pocket-sized flashlights. They're tactical, which I think the word tactical now just means it's something you can attack somebody with if you need to. It's not that they're tactical, it's that they're attackable. Anyway, you could stab somebody in the head with this flashlight if you really wanted to. I would hope that you wouldn't want to or need to. But anyway, these flashlights that I will talk about later in a future podcast, they're little rechargeable flashlights. The light lasts for at least an hour, certainly enough for most emergencies. And it has a feature that I like in that it is white, red, and UV all in the same light. You just press the button until you get what you want. And all three of those lights are useful. You would want a white light just for general illumination. You'd want a red light for times when you wanted to preserve your night vision, such as at RMSS. And UV light is more useful than you might think. It basically lets you see things that you can't see under other forms of light. And while it's certainly fun, it's also kind of useful. For example, it's nighttime and you dropped your medicine on the floor and you can't find it. Well, if you can't find it with a regular light, try a UV light, because a lot of pills will glow under UV. It's not that they fluoresce or anything like that. It's not like they put a UV dye in them or anything like that, although not a bad idea, maybe. But no, it's just that they tend to be white, and that white will just pop out on the floor. Even if the floor is dirty or whatever, that pill will pop out, and you'll be able to find it better with UV light. It's also useful for checking to see if you have scorpions under your rig, because scorpions glow in UV too. So that is my approach right now. I've got both of those, and I feel completely covered for flashlights at night. The one thing we haven't covered is lanterns, where, you know, it used to be when you went camping, you'd have this big gas or oil lantern, and you'd carry it out and put it on top of the table, and everyone would gather around the lantern, and you would light up this huge area. I don't typically do that. I haven't found a need, but if I do need something like that, well, the headlight can actually do that. You can turn a headlight into a lantern simply by turning it inside out and wrapping it around a water bottle. The water will diffuse the light and spread it out farther, and while it certainly doesn't compare to a Coleman lantern or anything like that, it's enough to create a central area of light that could be useful if that is what you needed to do. Anyway, those are my thoughts on flashlights. Happy to hear yours if you happen to have any. I am Jeff at built2go.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And I would like to hear from you. Product review. My friend John, a.k.a. Hiker, who I met at VanFest and we've been chatting online for a long time now, showed up at RMSS with all these gadgets, and I was instantly on Amazon buying these things. So I've got product reviews covered for the next several months at this point. And one of the things he had, and his wife Wendy, by the way, they both recommended these things, was a broom. And while I don't typically get excited about, you know, household cleaning things, I have a problem that this thing solved. So in the Airstream, much bigger than most people's vans, you know, that's kind of a different sort of life than van life, but that's what we stay in when we're down at our river property. I have a broom because, you know, you got to sweep these things out all the time. That's just part of camping. I have a vacuum too, but a broom is often quicker and easier and actually more effective sometimes than the vacuum. So I go to get the broom and it's in the closet, but the closet, because it's in a camper, isn't a full-size floor-to-ceiling closet, and, well, the broom doesn't fit. And it's an aluminum or steel, steel-handle broom. So I have to unscrew the head and then put it together every time I want to use it. It's really not convenient, and the broom head is too big, and I know, you're thinking, well, duh, Jeff, just get one with a wooden handle and you can cut the handle down. Yes, that works. A lot of people do that. They'll cut the handle in half and have like a little hand broom. That totally works. But it's getting hard to find wood handle brooms, and this is better and cheaper. This broom doesn't really have a brand name that I could find, but it's under $8. And what it has, its killer feature, is the handle is in segments, and you can screw on or unscrew more or less handles to make the broom exactly the size you need. Or you can have a big tall broom when you're sweeping the floor, or then take off all but one segment and you can sweep off counters and get above cabinets, or hell, brush your dog down. I don't know, whatever you want to use a broom for. And did I say it's under $8? This is a perfect van life broom. And it works. It's cheap, obviously, and the metal's a little thin, and if you abuse this thing, you're going to break it, there's no question. But the brush itself is very firm, and it's shaped in such a way that you can get into little nooks and crannies, and, well, I love it. I consider this to be a bargain. It's $8. And you can search for these on Amazon, but honestly, in this case, I think you should follow my link. Not for the Buku affiliate dollars, which, for $8 ain't gonna be much, folks. But because I don't know how else to get you to find it, there's no brand name. It's just like, you know, broom. In fact, here, I'll read you the description. It is Handy Broom, indoor-outdoor brooms, duty kitchen broom for home, garage, kitchen, office, courtyard, lobby, patio, lawn, or concrete. It comes in red or orange, but if you buy the orange one, it's a dollar more. I don't know why. Yeah, this is just a no-brainer for me. If you have a camper van or a truck or a tent or anything that you need to sweep, this stupid little simple broom will be the broom that will absolutely work for you because you can make it any length you want. So I have a link in the show notes. Sometimes I get a little bit overexcited about very simple things, but boy, there's just nothing like scratching that little itch of something that just doesn't work, and then something comes along that does, and it's cheap. It's like Christmas. Tales from the Road. So I just got back from the Rocky Mountain Star Stair, sponsored by the Colorado Springs Astronomical Society. To be clear, this is a big piece of land, about 35 acres up in, well, I don't know, it's in Huerfano County, let's say. It's near Gardner. 7,700 feet in elevation and dark, dark, dark skies. And the entire point of this event is that they pick June when the days are long, which is actually a little backwards, but the temperatures are good. That's what it is. And they pick the new moon, the first new moon of the month, which a new moon is a black moon or a missing moon. And basically, it's the best viewing conditions possible all year. And we had some very, very good nights. We could basically see anything that can be seen. And that's a lot. I mean, I bring up the example that my first time doing this, they saw Charon, or Charon, however you want to pronounce it, the moon of Pluto, with a telescope. Naked eye, photon from the sun zooming out to this moon and then bouncing off of it and then coming all the way back to Earth to stop in the eyeball of the observer. Think about how much time that takes. Actually, I'm going to do that math. It takes 4.5 to 5 hours for a photon to eventually get it out of the sun, which takes a very long time. It takes 5.5 hours at light speed to get to Pluto, or its moon, give or take. And then it's going to take that time again, minus 8 minutes or so, to get to the Earth. So basically, this photon has been traveling at the speed of light, as photons generally do, gone all the way to the farthest reaches of the solar system, bounced off of something, and then come all the way back, gone through a few lenses and mirrors, and then whacked you right in the eye. That's the kind of thing you can do at RMSS, and that's its main attraction. But this year, for whatever reason, the vibe was a little different, and I don't know what this means, but I'm going to tell you about it. So several van life folks came. I've been talking about this event on the podcast for years, and there was Yogi and David and John and Wendy and Bryn, who came from the podcast, and I was very nice to meet you for the first time, if I met you for the first time, and some of you guys were super, super generous helping out the event, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. And everybody was doing their own kind of star watching. My star watching is to just sit there and look up and see what I can see. I typically am not all that interested in looking in telescopes, which is bizarre, and everybody around me at the event doesn't believe me, and they're like, hey, come look at this fuzzy white thing. It's different than the last fuzzy white thing you looked at. That's just me. I'm weird in that case. These people can appreciate the majesty of that photon bouncing all that, and for some reason, it just doesn't do anything for me. But what does do something for me is finding a flashing light in the sky and then using an app to look it up and realize it's a piece of a failed Soviet launch from 1967. It's a tumbling piece of space junk. And I'm seeing that. Somebody put that up there and it's gone around the Earth for 50 years. And now I'm seeing it. I don't know why. Having that little human connection makes it interesting to me in a way that a far-off galaxy just doesn't. But that's me. Most people find the idea of seeing another galaxy just overwhelming. And I completely understand, because it makes sense to me on paper. It's just not what I experience. Some people are doing astral photography, which is difficult. We'll talk about that in a second. And other people were using these massive telescopes to see things that are just amazing. A lot of technical skill in telescopistry? Telescopy, I think is the word. Looking through telescopes. There's a lot of technical stuff here, a lot of technical stuff in photography, and all different levels of experience out there in the field. I mean, there's over 400 people. But something very interesting happened on the last night. The last night, the forecast was for overcast skies, and there generally wasn't going to be all that much to see because, you know, these are light telescopes. They're not radio telescopes, and, yeah, you need to be able to see past the clouds. So a lot of folks rolled out early. They packed up and left, and not everyone. A bunch of us were there just to be there, and, you know, we would like to see the stars, but it wasn't the only reason we were there. And we were sitting around, and we looked up, and we noticed, holy cow, the clouds have opened up, and we can see everything. It turned into a very good viewing night, but nobody was viewing, at least in the group we were in. In fact, the group, which was, imagine a campfire group without a campfire, that's basically what it was. We're sitting out there in the dark, no lights, and more people came. And that last night, which would have been a good viewing night, turned into just a social night where everyone just hung around and talked about life, etc. And it was good. And for me, that is actually the prime reason I go there. These are wonderful people. I like spending time with them. And it kind of just brought up this idea that we have evolved to sit around campfires and quote-unquote chew the fat. There's something in us that wants that to happen. We're used to that. We even know, like, instinctively to make a circle. And if there's any light source, whether it be a fire, or nowadays, a TV, which is like kind of the modern campfire, sort of. Or, and I've seen people do this, they take all their flashlights and kind of put a sheet over them and make a fire. I mean, whatever. That is a normal way for people to be, and for many of us, that is kind of a craving. And, you know, VanFest did that. All my camping experience as a youth with Boy Scouts or whatever, that was the night, that's what we did. The big event of the week was a campfire. And there's a little calling to that at RMSS, where we're outside looking at the skies the way our ancient ancestors might have done, and we know a whole lot more about what's going on up there than they did. And I don't know, it was just kind of a little bit of humanity that I really appreciate. And sometimes things got pretty emotional there. There were a bunch of events that week that were more emotional than you would think. And, I could blame the altitude. I could blame a lot of things, but they were real. Now, there's a couple interesting observations here about this weekend. First was that the sky ain't the sky no more. It is not the same sky. Even since I've been doing this event, and my first time there was about 10 years ago, the sky has changed. And it's because of SpaceX or Starlink. There are so many satellites now that it's not hard to find a satellite. I mean, I remember when I was 13 laying in a field in New Hampshire, the first satellite I saw was, that's a satellite. I can see a satellite. And you get a knack for spotting them if you look at the sky long enough. These are fairly slow-moving, solid dots of light that obviously don't change direction, but they just keep going, and you say, oh yeah, that's a satellite. Now, there are so many of them that if any given moment you look up, you'll see five or six of them going in all different directions. And most of them now are SpaceLink satellites. In fact, they're almost cluttering the sky. I'm not going to go so far as to call them space litter, but it's noisy up there now, which is interesting that just like in my lifetime, we've made the sky noisy at night. It's kind of, meanwhile, we're all using Starlink in the campground to look up what we're looking at. So, you know, there's a lot of irony there, too. But, yeah, the night sky is different. And unfortunately for me, that has taken away some of the majesty of it, because just like with geocaching, where there are now so many geocaches that finding one no longer has the thrill it once did, the thrill of finding a satellite is zero now because there's so many of them. The thrill now would be finding a specific satellite or finding a tumbler, which is an object that basically tumbles in space and thus flashes as the shiny part reflects the sun back down. It was a good event. We used our UV lights there a few times to see interesting things. And in fact, John and his wife Wendy brought me a very special gift of euperlite, which is a stone that can only be found, well, pretty much. Let's say this, a stone that is found in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, And what's special about this stone is that in daylight, it just looks like a rock. Look at that. You've got a rock. Isn't that special? But under UV light, it glows in this weird, dappled, orangey glow. And it's actually pretty darn cool. So I have added that to my collection of treasured objects. Thank you guys for giving me that. And I was glad to have the UV light to see it. So now I think a UV light is going to always be part of my rig. And one last bit about RMSS. We had a conversation about, like, hey, there are people coming here because of van life. Is that an opportunity? Is it a problem? Whatever. I mean, it could be both. You know, if somebody were to put this event on iOverlander and not properly label it as a private event that charges admission that is on private property, yeah, there could be people camping up there just illegally, and we absolutely don't want that. So there is some risk to exposing this to a community that it's not entirely intended for. That said, if you have an interest in astronomy, RMSS is a great event, and it's cheap. It's less than $100 to secure a boondocking camping site, and you can just take in the stars all night long. I will be back next year, I hope. Obviously, now things change so often, it's hard for me to predict, but I'm planning on being back next year, and I would like to see you there as well. A place to visit. I am going to get on an airplane, shocker, in about 10 days or so, and I'm going to fly from Chicago to Amsterdam, and then I'm going to get on another plane, a much smaller plane, and fly to Belfast, which is a place I did not have on my bucket list, especially given the news of late. And in Belfast, I'm going to hop into a taxi and drive about 8 minutes and get on a ship, a ridiculously fancy ship, not my normal fare, but there was a special circumstance and I will be on this ship. It's called Regent Seven Seas Grandeur, and it's very luxury ship. I'm a little uncomfortable about that, but we'll see how it goes. But why am I getting on the ship in Belfast? Because it's going to, after a brief stop in the Faroe Islands, Iceland. It's going to Iceland, and it's going to hop around a little bit around Iceland and drop us off in Reykjavik, which you would expect, and I will fly home from Reykjavik. All that to say, that's why this is on my mind. Iceland has something very special that I don't know any other place that has this, but in Iceland, it is very easy to go there and rent a camper van. It is a cultural thing. Renting a camper van is just so super common that there's a whole bunch of different services. One that I will link in the show notes is called IndieCampers.com. That's I-N-D-I-E Campers.com. And it's a bit like the many services we have here in the U.S. where people put their vans up for rent, but you can take a look there to see the options, and you can rent a camper van for a couple days or a week or whatever and see all kinds of amazing things for a fairly affordable price. So here's the thing. It's Iceland. It's European, Scandinavian influenced. It's expensive, and hotels are very expensive. Food is very expensive. Van life makes perfect sense here because for $250 a night or so, you can get a vehicle, a kitchen, and a place to sleep, and that's awesome. Plus, you're going to be sleeping on an island in the middle of the Atlantic with amazing views, possible chances to see the Aurora Borealis. You're going to see a geyser named Geyser. Why is it named Geyser? Because it's the first one that had a name. You're going to see giant waterfalls. You might even see a crashed DC-3 on a beach if you're going to head that far out. Iceland is wonderful. Great wildlife. Not a lot of trees, but still, really super interesting place to visit. And if you're interested in van life, you would just like to try van life, you have a golden opportunity here. Fly to Iceland, rent a camper van, try it out, see if you like it. It would be easier to do it there than just about anywhere in the world. One other note, and this is my first trip to Iceland happened this way. Iceland Air has a special program where if you do a stop off in Iceland on your way to Europe, they will let you spend a few days in Iceland at no additional cost. That means if your flight costs $600 to fly from, say, Chicago to London, you can stop in Iceland on the way, spend a few nights, and then continue on to London. I actually don't know if they fly to London, but you know what I mean. That's a great thing. I mean, that's like, it's almost like a free flight. They're not going to pay for your hotel or anything. You still got to pay for that stuff, but you don't have to buy two separate flights. They let you stay over for a few nights. You could actually do that and rent a van and drive around. Now, there's one big caveat with all this, and this is true for anybody who is new to traveling outside North America. Europe is still primarily manual transmission, standard shift. Automatic transmissions are a little bit weird there. They're seen as luxury items. And where gas prices are high, as they are in Iceland, and I'm not talking about recently. I mean, of course recently, but they're always super high to the American eye. They are manual shift. So you have to learn how to drive a stick to rent vehicles. Most of the camper vans are manual, and almost all, it's getting to be a little better if you rent a car in Europe now. They're starting to have more automatics because they know there are a lot of Americans out there. But do not think that you will learn as you go and get a manual shift and head out on the road. Don't do that. Manual shift requires skill and training. You have to learn how to do it. You have to get some feel for it. You have to establish some muscle memory to do it safely. If you just fly over there and think you'll figure it out, you're going to have a bad time. It's going to be dangerous, and you're probably going to damage the vehicle, if not everything else in your way. So don't do that. But all that said, this is a really cool way to see some amazing parts of the world, to experience van life. And heck, if you already have a van and you want to bring it over to Iceland and drive around, you can do that too. It's going to cost you maybe $10,000 in shipping fees, and it's going to take weeks and months. And just rent one. Just rent one. It's going to work out so much better. So I have a link in the show notes to this one company. There's another company called Happy Campers that's very popular. When you get over there, you're going to see these camper vans everywhere. There is no "we hate camper vans" attitude in Iceland at all. They love it, and partially it's because it's become such a popular tourist destination that the hotels are full. So this is a way to get more tourist dollars in without like driving people out of the city. Resource recommendation. This is a resource, so I'm going to bring it up. And I've talked about this before, but it's Vanly, V-A-N-L-Y, and it's an app. It's a website. Vanly.app is the website. And the idea is that it is an Airbnb-type service for people who have places that vans can park. I love boondocking. I love stealth camping, but there are times where I have a schedule and I have a difficult place to be, and I absolutely want a safe, legal place to park. I had this situation in Burlington, Vermont a couple years ago, and I did actually go through Airbnb and found a space and paid a ridiculous amount of money to park in some guy's driveway, but I was happy to do it. This is a service for that. Now, that all sounds great, but I played around with it today to see what I could see, and it has a lot more listings than it used to, but they're not evenly distributed. For example, there were none in LaSalle, Illinois, near Starved Rock. There were literally nothing there. Salem, Mass., where I need a place to park, they were recommending places in New Hampshire, which is fine, but it's 45 to 90 minutes away. It's not exactly what I'm looking for. And so I looked at other places like Orlando, and yeah, there were some places around Orlando, but I don't know. I think they need to increase the number of sites they have. And then the other thing is there's the price. Chicago had a bunch of sites, but some of them were $50 a night. You're going to pay $50 a night to stay in driveway when it's not even really where you want to be. You know, in that case, I might try to stealth it. I don't know. Anyway, take a look. See if you have a trip planned and you absolutely need a place to park. They might have the solution for you, but I'm not entirely sold on this. And another note, and this is really strange, their website is super hard to use. First off, you have to create this elaborate account to even access the service. They get all kinds of information from you, like your phone. You have to verify your phone number, even to just look at the listings, which I think is crazy. And then the search just kind of doesn't work. I mean, you type in where you want, and then there's no obvious search button, except sometimes there is this magnifying glass button, but it doesn't actually do anything. I don't know what's going on there. I was using this on my Mac. It wasn't like I was trying to make it work on my phone or anything. It's quite possible that the app is the better interface. But all that said, it is a resource that could come in handy for some folks. And it's not a contract thing like with Harvest Host where you have to like pay an annual fee and then, you know, make arrangements at every place you stay. This would be a one-off thing. Verified folks, you will have a contact. You will have permission to park there. You won't get the knock because it will be all legit. And sometimes that is worth some money. So that's vanly.app. I have a link in the show notes. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 298. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. If you need to get a hold of me for any reason, I am Jeff at built2go.com. That's two T's, not three, not one. And until next time, remember the words of John Muir, who said, "And into the forest I go to lose my mind and find my soul."